Morning, everyone. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee meeting to order. Representative Pugh, could I have a motion on the minutes from yesterday, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes for March 23rd.
Representative Pugh moves the minutes from March 23rd. Any discussion to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are adopted. That Representative McNamara, welcome to Government Operations. Everyone here that the bill can go to the General Register. Is that jive with what you know?
Madam Chair, excuse me.
It's okay. It's early.
Mr. Chair, it needs to go to Environment, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Okay. Perfect. That's why we do that. With that, I will make a motion that House File 2866 be referred to the Committee on Environment Finance. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill is before you for your part, and your part of the bill, Mr. Chair, is section number. I'll let Commissioner Meyer identify himself and explain which part of the bill.
Sure, Representative McNamara. Yeah, we have the rulemaking portion of this bill. Mr. Meyer, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, good morning. I've been here all week long, it seems like. So thank you again for hearing this bill. This is a DNR policy technical bill from the administration. Section 14 of the bill on page 8 is the reason why we are here today. And this provides a proposal for the DNR, you'll see, to establish by rule procedures for the preparation, review, and approval of plans and regulations and updates thereto that are required by the designation of the Mississippi River Corridor critical area, and we're asking to use the expedited rule process to do this. We're in the process of going through a full-blown Chapter 14 rulemaking process, updating the Mississippi River Corridor critical area. We've been working on this intensely for the past 2 years, roughly, working with the local units of government, holding many meetings with them, addressing their concerns of the city's townships, and also the citizens in the area. The rule actually will go out for public notice and publish in the State Register, we're hoping, next week, and then begin the review process. So what this does, it will allow us to take those plans as they're updated and develop an expedited review process that is simpler than what's currently in statute. We have talked about this with the stakeholders. The cities do support this process, and they will be involved in the rulemaking that will take place here.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Representative McNamara, any further comments?
If you want, we could have someone from the cities testify, and if you want. Mr. Chair, it's up to you.
Let's see here. If they're welcome to, I guess. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? Come on down, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. The comments made by the agency are accurate. This would simply allow the DNR to get a process in place more quickly for how they will deal with local requirements for planning on this rule should it become finalized. So we would support this change.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rumbeck.
Just an informational question. Mr. Johnson, what are the boundaries of the critical area?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, it is the Mississippi River from the top end up in Corcoran down through Hastings, 1,000 feet on either side.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Johnson. Anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of the rulemaking provisions in this bill? Seeing none, we'll move on to member questions and discussion. Are there any member questions? Any member discussion? Seeing none, we'll give you the final word on your bill, Representative McNamara.
Thank you for the time.
You bet. With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 2866 be referred to the Committee on Environment Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Mr.
McNamara. Next, we're going to take up Representative Nash's bill. And Representative Nash, once you get settled in, you can go ahead and make a motion to send your bill to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2585 to the General Register, and Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment that I would like to move as well, the A1.
Representative Nash makes a motion that House File 2585 be referred to the General Register. Representative Nash moves the A1 as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Representative Nash, you want to discuss the amendment?
Mr. Chair, it's a pretty simple amendment. It changes the language for the 30-day notification for the interim ordinance to move to a 10-day notification. This is in consultation with members from the League, from the League of Minnesota Townships as well, to work towards the Zenic peace in the Valley.
Members, any questions before we put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Representative Halverson.
I don't believe that Representative Nash is on the Commerce Committee, but I do believe there's a quarter fine for peace in the Valley now.
Yes.
I'll buy some peace.
All right.
Thank you, Representative Halverson.
With that, members, Representative Nash moves the A1. All in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Nash, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill is pretty straightforward. It creates a requirement for notification for the utilization of interim ordinances for a moratorium on residential-only growth or projects. And the rationale behind this is really to provide folks who will be affected by this the opportunity to come forward, to share their concerns before an interim ordinance is enacted for the moratorium. Currently, under Minnesota law, there is no need to provide a hearing time or notification, and I just think that really for those that may be affected, for those landowners, for people in the trades who may be going forward to build whatever residential unit could be there, that it is really something that is not an onerous requirement to provide them an opportunity to share their thoughts, make an appeal, and to really bring their case before the governing body. And I wanted to say this has got some good solid bipartisan support. I wanted to thank Representative Nelson for joining me on this bill. I think that this is something that really is designed to promote openness and transparency for the people who are going to be affected by the utilization of this interim ordinance. I do have some testifiers, and would be happy to hand it over to them now, sir.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Nash, for moving your bill forward. My name is Remy Stone. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota. We're a trade association. We represent roughly 3,000 members and nearly 80,000 employees in the state of Minnesota. Like any other business in this state, we rely on some form of consistency in government regulation and certainly a degree of stability in understanding how we can use our property. And there, with that comes a vested right, or at least a presumed interest in being able to use the land as we have purchased it. And as you know, we represent home builders, and we are very interested in moving housing product forward into the marketplace to make sure that Minnesotans have quality and affordable homes. We have found over the years that the moratoria issue has frustrated our ability to move forward with projects and have popped up at the 11th hour without any prior notice. And with that, we've also come to engage with our local government friends to try and figure out a way to manage these last-minute moratorias when we have projects moving forward. In addition to the notice provision in this bill that we fully support, and we do support the 10-day alteration, we also are very interested in making sure that this is treated like a normal zoning change, which requires a two-thirds majority, because there is a property rights issue here, and it goes to the fundamental rights that people have with the use of their property. So we also support that provision in this bill. I would answer questions, but you have up here with us Mr. Pete Coyle, who practices this stuff daily, so he's going to be probably your better answerer to your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Coyle.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and staff, my name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lawyer with Larkin Hoffman, and I represent the Builders Association of the Twin Cities, which is a member of the statewide association that Ms. Stone is in charge of. I'll just step you back for a second. For those of you that are not quite so familiar with local government zoning policy and statutory authority, first of all, as you may know, cities in Minnesota are creatures of the legislature. Their powers come entirely from actions of the legislature. So it's appropriate for this bill to be before you for that reason as a starting point. Secondly, we're dealing with property, so there's a constitutional element to this issue as well that I just want to bring to your attention. Thirdly, the reason the bill is here is because under Minnesota law today, if a city wants to enact a development moratorium, they can do so unilaterally, without notice, without a public hearing, whenever they want. And the property owners, the business owners, the companies that are affected by that action have no recourse. And we're not proposing to change any of that ultimate authority by this bill. We would like to introduce a little bit of fairness in the process because today, respectfully, we would suggest there is none. And the bill addresses that in two ways. But I will tell you that the issue of moratoria has been a vexing problem for home builders and the developer community in Minnesota for a very, very long time. And while we sincerely respect the need for cities to use moratoria to plan for their communities on a thoughtful basis, and we're not opposed to that on any level, we object to the untimely way in which these are implemented. And in some instances, we object to the notion that they can be done on a simple majority vote basis, which would suggest a lack of a consensus on the elected body's council, that there's really a sincere need to move forward to the moratorium. So the bill, as Representative Nash has suggested it, addresses that policy area in two ways. For moratoria in general, it would require that a city enact the moratorium on the basis of a two-thirds vote of the council, or in the case of a township board, the two-thirds vote of the township, which are already two-thirds bodies. We think that's a reasonable change because it will ensure that before the city takes this really dramatic action to freeze property, potentially for a year, and potentially with the opportunity to change the rules under which the property was purchased and a development application was made, the rules could be changed in such a way that the application would no longer be viable. And that's very concerning to our members. And then secondly, the idea that there would be for housing projects only, the notion that there would be advance notice of the hearing with an opportunity to come in and say, I mean, really, is this necessary? Is there something we can work with you to fix? What's the problem that you're trying to solve with this really dramatic action that we might be able to forestall by just having a direct conversation before you take this step? At the end of the day, following both of those steps that we're proposing with Representative Nash's bill, if the council feels like it needs to take the action, it still can. So those are my comments, Mr. Chair, members. If there's questions for me about the bill, I'd be happy to respond to them at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. Representative Nash, I think we're just going to continue with testimony. We'll go down through the list here that we have. Next on the agenda, I have Mr. Tom Grundhofer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grundhofer, General Counsel for the League of Minnesota Cities. First want to express our appreciation to Representative Nash for taking the notice period down from 30 to 10 days. It makes it consistent with the kind of the notice period that's already in state law for other zoning amendments, and I think it's certainly appropriate to appreciate that. With having said that, we still oppose the bill for several reasons. First of all, contrary to what Ms. Stone mentioned, the vast majority of zoning changes are not approved or do not require a two-thirds zoning amendment. They require a simple majority. In fact, that has been the trend that the legislature has adopted over the last several years. They've gone away from supermajority requirements to a simple majority. Second, this bill has been talked about in the sense of housing, but the two-thirds voting requirement for interim ordinances applies to every kind of interim ordinance, regardless of whether it's housing, commercial, retail. Any kind of limitation of an interim ordinance would require a supermajority, regardless of whether it's housing. Our third concern, maybe is our biggest concern, is the fact that the language talks about an interim ordinance related to housing. So while it's been talked about that this bill is all about housing, the reality is the wording of this of the proposed bill does not limit it to housing. Any particular use that has any component of housing, an apartment or whatever, would be subject to the restrictions of this particular bill. And I'm not sure that that's the intent, but certainly if any kind of commercial or retail establishment that might have an apartment above the activities, that would be subject to the limitations of this bill. And again, I'm not sure that that's the intent, but the way the Minnesota Supreme Court has interpreted the phrase related to in the recent years, it's a very broad term. So anything that touches at all on housing is dealt with in this. And then frankly, we're just philosophically opposed to the limitations on the use of interim ordinances. This legislature has, from a policy standpoint, said that interim ordinances can be appropriate to protect the planning process. It's been the law for a long time. What this bill does is put this extra notice period on and frankly allows some uses to sneak in, if you will, under the radar screen. Local governments need to be able to adopt something quickly and effectively to head off surprise kind of uses that they might encounter. So that's our concern with the bill. We continue to stand ready to work with Representative Nash on trying to particularly maybe deal with that question of related to housing and tightening that up a little bit. So stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Grunhofer. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. And I guess I'm asking Mr. Grunhofer because is there anybody on from environmental groups, do you know, today? Because this is very close to the same type of things we've been seeing over and over since before around 2009 or 2010 about the same thing. And in the past, the environmental groups were always extremely opposed to it, as were in the metro area. We have a lot of neighborhood organizations, and they've been always extremely opposed to this type of legislation. As I recall, this was brought, I think, first by Kelly Dorn because of a thing over at the U. And this is similar. So do you know whether they're involved or if there's a big difference between this one and all of the similar ones? And
Mr. Grunhofer.
Mr. Chair, members, I do not know of the particular interest of the environmental groups. It does not surprise me that they have historically been had concerns with this, because it does to a degree tie the hands of local governments in order to respond to some sort of unanticipated scenario. But I don't know for sure on that.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, when this bill came up way back when I was chairing civil law, and
that was a long time ago.
Yeah. I don't know if you were even here then. And it was readily trashed and really went down in flames. So I'm wondering, is there huge changes from the ones that appeared back then, or
Mr. Grunhofer?
Mr. Chair, members, having been through these, I'll call them wars, in the past as well, this is a tighter bill in the sense that it's trying to deal with housing and not other kind of commercial. That said, the way the language is, I remain concerned about it flowing over into other things. So,
Mr. Chair, that was obviously a housing bill. It was Dorn brought it because of some University Avenue housing over there across the street from you. So sounds a lot the same.
Thank you, Mr. Grunhofer, for your testimony. And certainly hang around in case there are additional questions. But the final two testifiers I have are Kathleen Duran Norton and Ryan Hamilton. It looks like I was handed a card from Mr. Alan Parrish. So we'll take the three of you in that order. So if you would just...
Good morning. How are you?
Be ready. Welcome to the committee. If you would, please introduce yourself for the record, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I left the paper copy in the car. good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name's Kathleen Doran Norton. I've been a township supervisor in Bridgewater Township, Rice County, for the last 10 years. And my township started planning and zoning 9 years ago. Townships can do planning and zoning. We have to be at least as restrictive as the county, but we may be more restrictive. And we took on planning and zoning when a very large project was proposed for our township. We used an interim ordinance to accomplish that change, and several citizens committees met for a year to accomplish that. And we think that, you know, this is the kind of citizen participation in democracy in its best. When I read the bill, as others have said, I found the purpose unclear, and talked with our planner, what are activities related to housing? Does this include such things as group homes, temporary family health care dwellings, seasonal worker buildings, retail with apartments above, maybe retail that supports housing? Does it include accessory uses to housing? What about setbacks or density or lot widths or height or square footage that could be related to housing? If Minnesota state government intends to change the rules for local government, we ought to know clearly what it is that's being included and excluded. We appreciate the amendment that moves the notice from 30 days to 10 days. That's a helpful sort of thing. Appreciate that, but the requirements for supermajority is puzzling. My town board has three members, but many town boards have five members, and I don't understand why this particular land use requires a supermajority. Particularly when this uses related to housing are so unclear. Throwing up barriers that for important local decision making is harmful to local government units and the citizens they serve. Development can include impacts to local roads. Development near our township put 500 vehicles a day on a road. It could include water systems or sewer treatment that needs to be expanded because of that. Local government needs to be concerned about both the private developer as well as the public concerns. So I urge you to consider that and vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norton. Mr. Hamilton?
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ryan Hamilton, Associate Legal Counsel with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. I'm here on behalf of our 17,000 plus members to request your support and passage of House File 2585. Let me begin by making it clear that realtors have the utmost respect for the authority that municipal governments have been granted to protect the planning process and the health, safety, and welfare of their citizens. Unfortunately, a growing number of cities have embraced emergency moratoria as a means to address non-emergency land use issues such as rental housing and residential design standards. We believe that using interim ordinances in this manner is violates due process and runs contrary to the original statute. The impacts of emergency surprise ordinances have gone beyond harming the property owners. They can cause an undue burden to small businesses, tradesfolks, and future residents of a municipality. Picture, if you will, a couple from, let's say, Iowa, and they're planning to move to one of your districts. They purchase a vacant lot or a foreclosure or a rundown property in your district. They hire an architect, hire a building contractor, hire a crew of tradesfolks. Days before they go to apply for their building permit, that community issues a building moratorium. So that crew loses the work hours. That home family's move gets delayed. You know, they time this thing financially and for the kids to start school at a certain time. So imagine that jarring impact on that family. Hypothetical scenarios such as that are based on real-life stories that me and my colleagues have heard while working on this issue. Stories like those illustrate the economic and emotional pain that surprise moratoria can have on homeowners and aspiring homeowners. A better way to address these types of housing-related issues is through an open dialogue where all interested parties can provide feedback to the council regarding the potential policies. Minnesota Realtors are supporting Representative Nash's bill because we believe it would add a much-needed level of transparency and due process to how housing-related moratoria and interim ordinances are enacted. Again, this bill does not seek to strip the municipal governments of their ability to enact interim ordinances or moratoria. What it will do is add daylight and dialogue to the front end of the process. By providing notice and opportunity, municipal governments will be able to hear all perspectives and be in a position to make a better decision and more informed decision regarding the policy. This bill provides a better way. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Last on the list, I have Mr. Alan Parrish. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would please introduce yourself for the record, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Parrish. I'm from Barville, Minnesota. I'm a retired dairy farmer. I've been a town treasurer for 29 years in Hartford Township. I also chair our county unit, which is an association of all of our townships in the county. And then I'm also a member of the Land Stewardship Project. Township are the original form of local government in our state. We're the most grassroots form of government and closest to the people. Township government powers stay strong and essential to strong rural communities. This bill weakens the powers that's why I'm concerned. Why interim ordinances are important to townships. An interim ordinance is an emergency power applied to township that allows the township to respond quickly to unanticipated development. For townships that doesn't have towning or zoning, because of the county zoning has worked for them in the past, this is often the only way they have to say something or to, when something unexpected or unwanted approaches or is proposed. Let's say someone is proposing some building units in the township that has not needed zoning before. The county doesn't have the work done for them. The housing developer may have months into this process with the county before the township even knows the proposal is or being aware of the proposal. If the county decides to go ahead with and allows them over the township objections, the moratorium is the only way to a township to have to say, and it only works if they have it can do this quickly. Townships have no paid staff generally, so they only meet monthly, and if they decide to go ahead with a moratorium, you know, after the meeting, then they have to talk to a lawyer. That takes a month before the next meeting to decide to go forward, and by the time you put a notice in the newspaper, and if that timing just happens to miss the next month. Pretty soon you got a couple of months going down the road before, you know, you can actually do anything. You take the issue up at the next meeting, you know, the project by then can be permitted and the township has lost their say. We can't make an emergency power so hard to implement. And as of yet, I've heard no examples of where a township misuse of an ordinance. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Members, move on to member questions and discussion. I have Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. When I first saw this bill, I was not as excited as I am now about it, I guess. I've been reading through a bunch of stuff, and I love the bill. I was looking through articles and case studies and everything, and there was a city that decided to stop issuing rental licenses. And let's say someone goes to buy a house. They're in contract. They're going to closing. They know it's going to be a rental. And before they decide to close, the ordinance is, or they're not going to issue any new rental licenses. Now you have someone that has bought a house, put money into the house, and is looking forward to that, and all of a sudden the city decides that there's no new rental licenses that will be issued. So now you have someone that has to either sell it, and there's costs involved in buying it. They have to close on it, pay the closing costs, and they have to relist it, pay a realtor, and there's no input given. And I love the process here, especially being my first year here. I love the fact that we can come here and discuss things. And I think this bill is just opening it up. Let's have a discussion. Let's see who is being affected by it to get everybody's point of view. Mm-hmm. With the rental license, it was just saying that in one city, it increased from 459 to 873 in 8 years. And I would ask the question, is that a bad thing? Are rentals bad? I know in Bloomington, where I am, there are not a lot of three-bedroom rentals, and sometimes houses are the only place people can go to get rentals. A big family, so they are out looking for that. And in the city, it's been, I think, six, seven, 8 months, and they haven't decided yet on what to do. And so I think there's just a lot of people that are affected by this. And just like we're doing here, you come and you can give your testimony, because the city council might not have all the information. They might have a couple. There was one that said the moratorium was in response to concerns brought forward by several residents. Is that 10? So if I have an issue with something, I can bring 10 people in to the city council and they'll change the law and affect it without knowing how it affects everybody. Also in Minneapolis, we saw that there was the moratorium that was done. Council members said, I'm trying to stop bad behavior. They unveiled it without notice because they didn't want to create a stampede at the permitting office. That was done on March 7th. On March 20th, there was the first opportunity to talk about it. 2 weeks later, they reached a compromise. So it looks like in that case, the city did what this bill would do, is they would say, let's notify everybody, let's have a hearing, let's talk about it, and let's come to a compromise. So I'm excited for this, that there's so many different people that it can affect, and let's just have a conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Well said. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think my questions might be for Mr. Grundhofer, if he's still here.
Sure. Sir Grundhofer, welcome back to the committee. Go ahead, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, Mr. Grundhofer, how many of these moratoria do we see typically in an average year?
Mr. Chair, Grundhofer. Members, less than 10, I would think. I don't hear many of them.
And Mr.
Representative Halverson.
And Mr. Grundhofer, with these 10 moratorium, do cities have processes in place once they pass the interim ordinance? What happens in cities after the interim ordinance that's passed?
Mr. Grundhofer. Chair, members, the statute is very explicit that you can't just pass an ordinance, frankly, willy-nilly. You have to have either at the time you pass it or before then
started a study of some sort to kind of figure out how to best deal with the particular use you're trying to address. So there's a very specific time frame involved. There's a requirement for studies to be implemented. So again, it's a fairly well-defined process that's included in statute now.
And Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, one of the concerns I heard was about the simple majority, and I think to the and then also kind of tightening up the language about relating to housing, and I guess for the author, are these issues that we could perhaps work on? It seems that, and I'm coming from this perspective that I am in a city that is doing a lot of redevelopment right now, and I will tell you it gets the citizens' attention, and I hear about it in my office, and of course this is a city issue, and this is their local government that's closest to them, and very often if you live in a city, and you wonder who's responsible for something, it's usually the city. If your street doesn't get plowed or whatever it is, it's the city government has a pretty big impact on our residents' lives. And so I want to be sure. I think that the idea of additional sunshine and really putting some belt and suspenders around how we notify and how we allow citizens to participate in this process is really good. But going to the point of having a supermajority to me seems a bit excessive when we look at the way cities handle other controversial issues. And I certainly in my community wouldn't want to hamper my city's ability to react to citizen concern, because I've seen that citizen concern. I've seen it divide neighborhoods. I've seen, you know, these things can get really, really dicey in communities, and we want to be sure that citizens have the best opportunity to be heard along the way, and so that cities, and also give our city governments the power to balance those interests. So is that something that the author might be open to?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, obviously you know my background, having come from the middle chair as a mayor of a city, and yes, I am willing to make sure that we work on some of the finer points of this. But I would say a couple things. One, a supermajority is required when the comprehensive plan is being changed for a municipality. And honestly, from my perspective, changing or affecting an interim ordinance for a moratoria is really putting the brakes on to the comprehensive plan. If something is guided for residential, you're essentially saying that's no longer a valid action. And it takes a 4/5 on a city council. Or if it's 7, it takes 5 out of 7 in order to change the comprehensive plan. And that's why I put the language in there. You know, from a township perspective, I believe all but 500 in the state of Minnesota are 3-member boards. So, you know, really to pass the minutes from the previous meeting, it takes 2 out of 3. So I'm not trying to make this onerous. What I'm trying to do is to be really someone who is offering the people that you mentioned in your city who could be affected the opportunity to come forward and have their concerns heard, and to ask the city council or the township board in that example to really make sure that the decision that they're about to make is the one that has the preponderance or the supermajority of the city council. What I will say, and I am happy to continue working on this. I think that it's important, and I think that citizens, as we do here, we make sure that people have the opportunity to come. I know that Mr. Coyle would like to come and address the number of instances of this, but I think that the simple fact that we have these in statute without really the requirement of any notification, I think that's something that we can and should act on, and that is something that we can say to city councilmen, city councilwomen, and mayors across the state that it is an expectation of good governance that we offer the ability to come and address your concerns.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, quickly before Mr. Grunhofer leaves, because I think Mr. Coyle could also address this. When we look at the number that are these interim ordinances that come about, how many kind of hang out there unresolved? I mean, did these things get resolved in the pardon me, my coffee hasn't kicked in. Kind of in the overarching goals of the comprehensive plan. I guess I have a trouble seeing this as a change in a comp plan when we're talking about things unexpected coming forward, that's actually a stop and readjust and make sure that what we've planned for is what we're getting. And so I just be curious how many end up unresolved.
Mr. Grundhofer.
Mr. Chair, members, statute is actually very explicit about how long they go. I think it's a year, but then you do have to, if you wanted to extend it any time beyond a year, there's actually a explicit public hearing requirement to go and go beyond that, and then it's kind of limited to how long you can extend. It's not for indefinitely, and the goal is to obviously to have that study resolved so you can figure out a permanent kind of solution to the scenario. And just for the record, we don't track the number of interim ordinances. This was kind of my reaction based on my reading of newspaper stories.
Okay. Mr. Grundhofer, before you leave, we have one more member question for you. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, if I could, to the previous comment.
Representative Nash.
Thank you. Representative Halverson, very good question. What I would say, and I'm sure that the builders and realtors would also say, that even just that year can kill a project. And it can hang it up so profoundly that the landowner goes underneath because they've got the carrying cost of that piece of land. They've hired people. They've maybe had materials purchased. And my simple request is that they have the opportunity to address that. I'm not trying to take away any tools from the toolkit of a city council. What I'm trying to do is to make sure that the people who are financially obligated to the taxes on that piece of land, or who have maybe hired people from the trades and have those materials being delivered on site, that they have an opportunity to come and make their case known.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. back to the rentals in the city. There's just a note here. So they place a moratorium, 180 days, and then they needed another 60 days. So in a case like that, whether or not they were going to issue rental licenses, that seems like a long time. And for them to be able to do that for a year, just to say no more single-family rental licenses would be issued, seems like a long time to me. So if they did this and 2 days later they did something about it, that's one thing. But I love conversation. I love hearing everything. And so I think that's what needs to be done to hear everything. So, thank you.
Mr. Grundhofer. Just to comment on that, I certainly understand that seems like a long time, but on the other hand, I don't think you'd want local governments to be deciding how they want to handle a policy issue, in response to sort of a knee-jerk kind of scenario. So that's the whole idea behind the plan, the studies, and to go through a thoughtful, comprehensive planning process. So I understand your point.
Thank you. Mr. Coyle.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll just quickly respond to a couple of points of discussion, and Representative Halverson, I'll start with the questions that you posed with Mr. Grundhofer, my good friend, Mr. Grundhofer, and I mean that. First of all, every city in Minnesota has to adopt a comprehensive plan. And that comprehensive plan, as Representative Nash said, must be approved by a supermajority vote of that body, whichever it is. So you start there. A zoning moratorium, as Mr. Grundhofer said, must be related to planning. Well, the master planning document for the city is the comprehensive plan. So in our mind, if you're going to take away somebody's property rights for as long as a year, there ought to be a consensus that it's really important. And since it relates to planning, if it takes three supermajority vote to pass the comprehensive plan, in our mind, it's only fair to suggest that a supermajority vote should be required to freeze a land use application that may be pending before the body for as long as a year. Second, there's already in statute a requirement that if a city wants to rezone property from residential to some other type of use, that also requires a supermajority vote. So this is not a novel idea. Cities do this all the time. In fact, I just finished a project in a western suburban community. Every decision they make is a supermajority vote of that body. So cities know how to do this. Frankly, this interim ordinance issue is as much political as it is policy, from my experience. And that's part of the frustration, is you have people who are following the rules that the city has enacted. This only arises when somebody shows up at City Hall wanting to do something that the comprehensive plan says they can do, and that the zoning ordinance says they can do. But all of a sudden, somebody says, whoops, we didn't know this was coming. They wrote the rules, respectfully. So all we're asking is that they abide by them unless they go through some kind of a fair process by which they change those rules. And that's really all this bill seeks to do. With respect to the resolution of these issues, just this week in one of our eastern suburban communities that is in its second development moratorium because it can't make up its mind whether to allow housing to occur on some kind of a reasonable basis or not, the city administrator asked the city council 6 months into the moratorium, you've not told us to do anything yet. What is it you want us to do? And got no answer. So I can just tell you from my own personal experience, having represented developers all over the state, as often as not, these are political decisions that are made hoping that the project just goes away so that the decision, the hard decision of actually upholding the ordinance, doesn't have to be dealt with at that particular moment in time. So I echo Representative Nash's point. This is a really important issue. This issue has enjoyed broad bipartisan support in the House in the past. We've had Democratic authors on this issue previously to this year, and I would certainly encourage your support, and we want to thank Representative Nash for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coyle, I take a little bit of umbrage to it becomes only a political decision. I feel like you're disparaging like all city councils out there with that. I mean, they're citizens that have been voted in by their fellow citizens to really be thoughtful and think about these processes. And the comprehensive plan does entail and include a lot more than just zoning. It takes over a year, usually, for most cities to put together the document, more so if you don't have a lot of staff. And sometimes those moratoriums are put into place because there's some confusion or gray area between their zoning and their comprehensive plan and what they want to do. So it's not always about some political gotcha game or trying to stop a development. Our local governments are really there, the closest to the people, and trying to listen to what their concerns are. And sometimes that takes some time to process through. That being said, I do appreciate Representative Nash's bill on Section C. I am all for notification and having that dialogue, and I hear you clearly when you say that. I'm still concerned and wondering why the two-thirds. Other moratorium that we put in place that affect businesses isn't two-thirds. So why just the two-thirds and why just housing?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, I think I may have just described it, but again, I view this, as do many other folks that I've talked to, mayors in my district, township members in my district, as this is indeed altering in a way the comprehensive plan that, as you know, requires four-fifths, because I know both of us have voted on comprehensive plans, and it takes a while. It is a deliberative process, and when you put the brakes on something that has been guided for pick a something, in this case residential, I believe it should face the same test as the comprehensive plan itself, which is a supermajority. And it's okay for us to differ on that, but that is the rationale that I had when we put that into the bill, because it does very clearly put the brakes on something that has been guided as such for a very long time. And I, when something's gone through planning and it's come up to the council and it's been voted on and then it moves on to where it's been platted and the mayor signs a plat, there's very little emergency nature of that. And that's why my particular view is that we should have a supermajority of the council members say, we need to put the brakes on this. And I'm not trying to remove that ability. I would never do that. But what I'm asking is that we afford the opportunity to the members of the public who are going to be affected that they have a notification, that they can come in and they can make their case, and that the decision that's being made is truly the supermajority or the overwhelming preponderance of council members, so that they say this is the decision that is required to be made. So that's why, Representative Joaquin.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. You're right. We both have served on councils, and I bet you about 90% of your votes, well, maybe not, about 80% of our votes were hashed out in work sessions, and we're very clearly a 4-1 or a 5-0 vote. But to put a supermajority on something that doesn't necessarily mean it's putting a brake on the comprehensive plan. It, like I said, I've heard of situations where it's just because zoning and planning might have misinterpreted or they're unclear, so they want to stop and wait and take the time to look at it again. Because when you have a 2-by-2-mile town like we do in Hopkins, you have to be pretty darn careful about how you redevelop and what you put next to each other. So it does take some time to really think about that, and I really err on giving the flexibility to the council to do that. And it feels like coming in with a supermajority when you have a council made up of 5 members, 4-1 seems like a lot to attain. And I actually have a question, because I'm trying to reach back in my memories. When you have a member absent, I can't remember. For some reason, we've had to bump things on the agenda, if I'm remembering right, if we have a member absent and a supermajority is required. Chair Sanders, I too have not had enough coffee today. Maybe Mr. Grunhagen can answer that for me.
Sure.
I said that wrong.
Mr. Grundhofer.
Mr. Grundhofer is coming forward, Mr. Chair, sure. if I could.
Got the G and the H in there, but.
I will make the joke that my votes were never cast in work session. They were always cast when we were on the dais.
And I
understand that work sessions
are... city council humor? Or
yeah. It's an inside joke.
Yeah.
It's an inside joke.
Sorry, I don't think it quite got to the table.
Mr. Chair, to avoid a serial meeting, you're not allowed to actually discuss your vote in a city council application. So I didn't want my friend, Representative Joachim, to be jammed up later on for her votes in retrospect. But, you know, it is an important decision. And I know we've got other members who have served on municipal councils. I think it's a very important thing to say that this is adversely or possibly changing the land use that has been guided in the comprehensive plan, and that is my request for the supermajority.
Mr. Grundhofer.
Mr. Chair, members, not to get too down in the weeds on how you count votes for supermajorities, but it actually varies depending on how the legislation is worded. For example, in this particular legislation, it's 2/3 of all of the city council. So regardless of whether somebody's there or not, you'd need 2/3. You'd count it based on how many are there, regardless of whether they're physically present or not. Other legislation is drafted differently. If somebody's missing, then it's just 2/3 of a majority or something like that. So it really does vary. In this case, it's all of the members, 2/3 of all of the members.
Follow-up, Representative Joachim.
I just wanted to get that clear in my head, too. So if you had a member that was sick all of a sudden that night, you would almost have to have all members voting yes then for it to apply, because it would have...
Mr. Chair, right? Members.
Mr. Grundhofer.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's right. Correct.
Thank you. I just want to get that clear. So thank you.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash. I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. I've had some concerns about how things go in different avenues of some of the things that we do in our life, and one most recently was with rentals, where St. Cloud wanted to have a moratorium on rental homes, single family, and we do quite a few of those ourselves, personally, my husband and I, and what wasn't taken in consideration a great deal was the fact that a lot of families, as Representative Anderson said, cannot afford to get a home. They can't afford to get into their home, and so renting a home was their best bet because they didn't want to live in apartments. And so we were very fortunate in that our city followed a procedure very much like this. They held a nice public meeting. We knew about it, could not attend. I had the opportunity to talk to several council members, but also our Realtor Association was there, and they had a wonderful dialogue, and what they ended up doing is forming a task force to look into this a little greater. And that basically is what most of us are looking for, just the opportunity to make sure that we feel like we have the discussions so that when decisions are made, they're made well. A neighboring city did have a moratorium on rentals on duplexes, and this I don't think was vetted nearly to the extent I think it should have been, in that now we had a client that lived in the city limits that wanted to prepare a little suite for a disabled brother who could live on his own but not alone, and they could not put a kitchen in it because then it would be a duplex, and that was not allowed. So I think when we don't do the vetting process, there are things like that that happen. And basically what they ended up doing is selling the home and going outside city limits, and there they could make the remodel and do the addition so that her brother could stay with them. Another thing is trash containers. I could go on for 4 years about this one because this really irritates me, in that all of a sudden there was just an ordinance that if you own a rental, you have to provide a trash container. Previously, the residents had, the tenants had to buy garbage bags, just like everybody else in the city of St. Cloud, buck a week, basically. But now for $25 a month, I have to provide the container. And if you have a duplex, that's two containers. It doesn't matter how big the space is, you still have to provide two containers. So now my rentals are littered with these trash containers, which absolutely drives me nuts. And we just didn't have the opportunity to say anything. But it was an additional $25 a month for me. So this is when the system doesn't work. And being in the building remodeling industry, as being chair of our Builders Association, we rely on the network to let us know what's going on. I know that it gets done in the paper, but I'm seriously, when we're busy, and I'm talking about builders, remodelers, anybody in the construction industry, when you're busy, my day starts at 6 o'clock and it would end at 8 p.m. So you don't have time to read the paper, and you rely on your associations to do that for you. And it truly is a little beehive of information going around, and we rely on that. So when we have the opportunities to do things like that, to say you've got 10 days, that really is important, because you can't just drop everything when you're doing a project, you're framing a project up especially. You can't just drop things and go. So I really appreciate the bill. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to take us back to our conversation with Mr. Coyle, but the comment was made, and I just wanted to follow up about, we're talking a lot about property rights of the developers, which I think are incredibly important, but the citizens of our community really believe that those go both ways, and what we hear a lot about from our citizens in our community when they have concerns about development that need to be worked out, and in our community they've always been worked out. Some more painfully than others, but they've been worked out, is that they really are concerned about their own property rights as well, and what their expectations are about what they purchased, what how things were going to change. We're going to go through another discussion in our community actually just this week, when another one started with a new development, and folks do want to be heard, and that's why I think there's a lot to be on board with this bill, but I do think that, and frankly I think I'd be 100% on board if it wasn't the supermajority. If that changed, I am on board, because I think that there's a lot to enjoy here, but my city just would have too many concerns about being hamstrung in that manner. It's too high. It's just a threshold that I think is too much for our city in these particular situations, the ones that we've lived through. So, thanks.
Thank you. Members, any final questions or discussion? Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair. Just one quick one, and I completely appreciate what Representative Tease has said about the notice, and I am with Representative Halverson. I agree with that portion. And the vetting process that needs to go on to make sure it's done well. The problem with this two-thirds majority is a lot of times what might happen is you don't get to have that vetting process then. You need the two-thirds majority to get to that vetting process. So then if it doesn't pass, that vetting process doesn't happen, and whatever the developer wants goes in place. And it's not that I am against that. I just want to keep a balance that's there so that we have the rights on both sides balanced out. And I feel like the current law does that. I feel like two-thirds supermajority would unbalance that. But we can, like you said, Representative Nash, agree to disagree.
Thank you, Representative Joachim, and thank you, members and the testifiers, for a great discussion on the bill. Representative Nash, maybe some food for thought while this bill heads to the General Register. Quickly, closing comments.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have made this commitment to members of the various leagues of people who are represented in the township, city. I am happy to have conversations, and Representative Halverson, Representative Joachim, I'm happy to sit down and chat with you. I'm not going to charge myself a quarter to achieve that thing, but I would like to get there so that we can all understand that really this bill is designed to allow people a process to be heard, to make sure that the decision that is being made is the very best decision on behalf of both landowners, people in the trades, and so on. I would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Nash. With that, Representative Nash renews his motion that House File 2585 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nash. Thank you, members. Next on the agenda will be House File 3549. Chair Scott, if you would take over, please. All right, thank you, members. I'll go ahead and move House File 3549 to Ways and Means. And we have here presidential primary bill in front of us. And Madam Chair, if it's okay, I have an A3 amendment that will be an author's amendment and will line us up with the Senate.
All right.
So I'd like to move the A3.
Members, the A3 is before us. Discussion on the A3. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A3 is before us. Are adopted. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, right now, the pages are handing out an additional amendment that I'd like to offer. This is to satisfy my original intent, I believe the intent of the parties and the intent of the townships. The way the bill is drafted right now, the language in page 2 says that the default date would be the week after the primary for caucuses. That falls on Township Tuesday and is also just not the intent. I think there's a lot more momentum and excitement leading up to the primary. So this amendment puts the default date as the week prior to the primary for caucuses and alleviates the concerns of it falling on Township Tuesday, at least as a default date.
Any discussion on the handwritten amendment? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First time I've seen an amendment like this, but that's fine. Do we have an amendment number that we're going to be referring to this as?
I would defer to House staff as to whether there's a number. There's not a number, so we'll refer to it.
This is an author's oral amendment written down, Madam
okay.
Chair.
That's an author's written oral amendment. Any other discussion on the author's written oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The written oral amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sanders.
And members, I know there's a few other amendments in the packet. Those are not mine. I mean, I'm happy to discuss those, and we can go through those. I know that there is one testifier down there, or we can. I mean, we had a very long discussion on this bill last week, so I don't know that we need to rehash everything. But certainly happy to go where the committee wants to go. So I'll just turn it over to you, Madam Chair. Which direction
right.
you want to go?
All right. Oh, we've got lots of questions. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the A2 amendment is my amendment, and I'd like to offer that now at this point. And what this does is, as we talked last week and we've been talking, as Representative Chair Sanders and I have been talking all along this process, we're dumping an additional election on local units of government, counties, townships, and cities. And what this does is sets up in statute a revenue fund to pay for this. And it would be the way it's written is the Secretary of State would estimate ahead of time what this would be. The year of a general election, a presidential election like this year, there would be an account set up that would be funded with the amount that the Secretary of State estimates, and then afterwards they pay out of that account, and then we'd have to put money into that if it doesn't meet all the actual costs. And this way we're not dumping an additional mandate and cost on our local governments. We're paying for this ourselves, and that's what the amendment does. And I stand for any questions. I move the A3 or A2 amendment.
Representative Nelson has moved the A3 amendment. The A2 amendment.
I stumbled also.
Further discussion, Representative Sanders, any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I agree with you that we need to help reimburse the counties for some of these election expenses. In the year of a presidential primary, this would be their third election, which is expensive and is a new expense to them. Currently in the bill right now, and maybe why I'd ask you to maybe withdraw the amendment, or we can vote on it if you wish. We have language in the bill right now that does what you're seeking in the A2, starting in section 13 on 7.29 and then again on page 8. And as well, we're going to Ways and Means with this bill, because as you know, the funding actually is so far out that we can't actually appropriate it right now. But the language is in subdivision 2 of that, and we set up reimbursement through the Secretary of State's office. So I think we've captured everything you want to do in the A2 in the bill, but the way this is written, I guess I would prefer to keep this since it matches the Senate language in the current bill.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair and Chair Sanders, I understand where you're coming from, and the big difference is that the bill as it's written requires an annual appropriation, where this would require an account set up. And it would be set up, it would automatically, wouldn't have to come back in 4 years after the next, be 8 years from now, and fund it again and fund it again. This would set up an appropriation that's there. And I understand the wanting to get this to going forward, but I think we need to look at this, and I know we also have time. And I agree we do have time to do this at another time, but I wanted to bring this up for discussion purposes and make sure the cities know that we are all on board of trying to make sure that we're not sticking it to them and giving them additional expenses without compensating them for it. So that's what the amendment is about. And I think at this time I will pull the amendment, but we do need to be cognizant of that, and we need to move forward on this either this year as this heads to the floor or the next two or 3 years, that we need to make sure that we're funding this properly so that we're not putting additional burden and mandate on our local units of government.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. The A2 has been withdrawn. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Sanders, after listening to your speeches over the years, I'm just wondering why you want to suddenly change and just take the words of the Senate, which is not exactly in line with a lot of your speeches.
Chair Sanders, you do have some splaining to do.
I know. You caught me, Madam Chair and Representative Mullery. You caught me. You know, I will say I think that the language we have here, I mean, has been, for the most part, widely brokered, even beyond the Senate, with a lot of stakeholders. So I can't say anything other than you caught me.
All right. Representative Mullery?
Madam Chair. And that scares me even more. Some of the people who are brokering, because I have less value in them than in the Senate, which is, I won't go on there. But I'm looking at this, and it's my understanding, maybe I'm wrong, but so two people can decide who goes on this ballot, rather than under the present system where people can file to be on the ballot. So if, as is alleged by the Sanders campaign, there's been an insider effort to keep him off of things, what you're doing is saying that all of the, for instance, Sanders people this year, who actually won in Minnesota, they could have been prevented from even having a say in this, if it's true that in a number of states, the whatever you want to call the party establishment didn't want him on there. So that, I mean, that's just after what happened this year, I just can't imagine having language like that in here.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, maybe we'd like someone from the Secretary of State's office to explain how we all, I mean, you always have to get to a place where a decision is being made as to who's going on the ballot. The difference between a primary a presidential primary and a different election, even different the general primary or the general election, is that in the presidential primary, it's the parties that are choosing their nominee and the voters of those parties that are choosing the nominee. So I hear it in every way. I mean, both parties right now are having fights over who should get what and how it's being done and who's being kept out and brokered conventions. And but at the end of the day, there does have to be a decision made as to who those candidates are. And I believe that the parties do have rules, and it should be beyond just the the director, the chair of those parties, and it's usually an executive committee that makes those decisions. To some degree, there has to be a threshold as to who's allowed to be on the ballot. I mean, that's the way it works in every election. But the difference here is that we are, as individual voters, choosing a nominee to represent us and to represent the party in the general election.
Ms. Strother, you want to?
Madam Chair.
Representative Mallory.
That's what we do in our primaries when you and I run and there's somebody runs against us in the primary. It's the same kind of attitude.
Let's have someone from the Secretary of State's office weigh in. Go ahead and please introduce yourself for the tape. Thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Minnesota Secretary of State's office. I think Representative Sanders answered the question well. This is slightly different than a regular primary where we're voting on who will be on the ballot, instead binding delegates for the national convention. And this does mirror the process right now where the parties make the determination of who's on this, the ballot for the straw poll.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, just maybe a clarification on Representative Mallory's comments before. He referenced the Sanders campaign and Sanders, and coincidentally, the author of this bill is also Sanders, and for the record, we are not talking about the same person. We're talking about two different individuals, one a U.S. Senator and one a Minnesota House member. So 150 years, when they ask, why did you do what you did, we'll clear that up for people right now.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Very good catch.
The fundraising has been going very well, though.
That's awesome. He's a .com and you're a .org with the same prefix, right? Yeah.
But Sanders 2016.
Yeah, very good. Awesome. Except you're not running for re-election.
Doesn't mean he's not raising money.
Very good. Any further discussion on that? Representative Runbeck.
Well, different topic slightly, Madam Chair.
Okay.
But so Representative Sanders, the same answer then, would it be then for how delegates are awarded? The parties are going to decide that, and one party could do it very differently than the other party.
Representative Sanders.
Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, that is up to the local state parties, MNGOP and the MNDFL, in accordance with how they operate and interact with the RNC and DNC, will choose how the delegates are awarded. Right now, it's proportional. In Minnesota, and I believe we even stipulate that in the language of, but it's proportional right now. That's how they've all agreed to do it.
To clarify, the bill does have language that says it's proportional?
No, Madam Chair, Mr. Guerin can comment as well, but my understanding is the actual decision is made by the state parties.
Mr. Guerin?
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, so the version of the bill that we saw last week and discussed did include some language about delegates were apportioned. Bill does not include that language, but on page 6, lines 24 and 25, there's just one sentence that says that the results of the primary must bind the election of delegates in each party, but then it leaves it up to the party to decide exactly how that process happens.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Runbeck, to follow up?
Madam Chair, it's fine.
All right. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, in other words, Representative Sanders, the party leaders could change from what we now have as a percentage, basically, to states like, I think it's Ohio and some of those that if somebody gets just an absolute majority by one vote, they get 100% of the delegates. So that change could be made by the party leaders despite Minnesota tradition of percentage.
Chair Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mullery, yes, but they can do that now as well. The parties have the authority or the autonomy to decide how their delegates will be awarded, and that's how it is now.
There's another amendment here, the DE1, Representative Lane. Is that yours?
Not a DE1, the A1 amendment.
I'm sorry. The A1, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment takes out the references to a closed primary and makes it, as we currently do, a state primary. So this would be the open primary amendment. And as I said before, I've told people in my district that don't worry, we won't have this difficult chaos of the caucus system that we had this time for the presidential primary, but I never assumed it would be a closed primary where you would need to state ahead of time which party's ballot you wanted, and then your ID, it's public information. In fact, it's also in this bill that you have to attest that you believe in the majority of the principles of that party in order to get that ballot. This changes the whole game in Minnesota, where we've had private voting, private choices. I know in a southern state, somebody that I know ran for a judge in a state where they elect their judges right off the bat, and the area was Republican, one of the people in the primary was by saying, oh, but she voted in a Democratic election once. So that you're
identified. Is there a problem with that?
Yes, I can think there's a problem with that. The point is that people in Minnesota feel pretty committed to being independent in how they vote, and it's private, and you could not say, well, I really, really like this particular candidate this year, and then 8 years later do another one. You would be doing this crossover as far as the parties go. I think it just makes for a much more divided political scene. And I like it a little bit more open than that. So I'm rather upset that we have this. I know that one of the ideas is that the national parties might not accept a primary done without having it closed so that you prevent other people from coming and ruining it. I don't think we ever have that happen. But actually, this everything you see pink here, 15 states have an open primary for their national parties to do their delegate, do their presidential nomination. And Wisconsin has identical to what would be here in this with this amendment. And they've had it for many years. There's been no problems. They have not been denied part of the nominating process in the national parties. So I consider that a moot argument. The thing that really comes down for me is the costs. As I say, when we are here, we can be very partisan, but we cannot do that when it comes to money. We cannot use our office phone to make partisan calls. We cannot use anything that has to do with taxpayer funding to use for partisan affairs. And here we are taking $5 to $6 million every 4 years, plus the offices of the Secretary of State and anything that has to happen at the counties or cities that is not covered by however we figure out reimbursing them. And we're saying this taxpayer dollars can be used for a partisan process in which the parties can identify you and have access to something that I consider to be private, as we have today. So I just really put forth strong emphasis on an open primary system.
Any comments, Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I know that this right now is probably the main point of contention and discussion, and certainly will be as we continue to move forward. I will just say that, albeit not extremely public information, we still have caucuses right now where you are literally driving to a precinct, to your precinct place, and you are choosing which side of the building or which hallway to go into, Republican, DFL, and you're joining in a partisan room with all of your neighbors, And, you know, sometimes it's interesting when you talk to the guy across the street or the family across the street, and they're telling you they were at caucuses, and you're like, well, you weren't in my room. So it's not exactly an open system we have here. I mean, you have to embrace the fact that you're willing to go to an MNGOP or an MNDFL precinct caucus and personally, publicly join with your neighbors to cast a handwritten ballot as of right now that goes to the parties where that information is captured, which precinct you attended, and you know, it's not completely, I guess you could say, open right now, in my opinion, either. I think that the bill currently is a good, happy medium. We're not asking anyone to register for a party, but we're just saying, and I understand where the parties are coming from, too, you know, that we are trying, as a state and as parties within a state, to choose who the nominee is going to be. And for me, it's a distinction because we're not asking Minnesota to choose between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, but it's who in Minnesota DFL thinks the candidate should be. So I understand and I'm sympathetic to the fact that, you know, it's not, you know, I don't think it's a huge infringement for folks to stand up and make a choice. You know, which party they want to belong to that day, or which ballot they want to choose for that day, because I think it's important to have the distinction that this isn't all of Minnesota choosing the Republican candidate. It should be the Republicans choosing the Republican nominee and the DFL choosing the Democrat nominee. So for those reasons, I would, at this time, oppose the A1 and certainly willing to have more conversations and you know, see if there's some happier, maybe more middle ground. I would say I think for those reasons, I think we have a good, happy medium right now in the bill.
Representative Lane.
Yes, Madam Chair. The caucuses, as we do them right now, cost the state taxpayers nothing. It's all paid for by the parties. We could have the same result paying for it through a state process, as long as we don't go to the closed system where the states, where the parties receive the benefit of this IDing. We can do the same thing we do now in a caucus system that is semi-private, to going to a private vote and have the same result for the parties without incurring the cost payers paying for party processes.
Any other discussion on the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. The oops, sorry. I should have hammered that. It does not. The A1 is not adopted. I see. Is there another one? Representative Halverson.
I'd like to offer the DE1 amendment.
Okay. To your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author, I apologize for not having this discussion with you ahead of time. I'm going to cop to that right now because I should have, especially with the DE1, and I'm not bringing this forward because I don't like your bill. I'm bringing it forward because of the questions that I think are weighing heavily on all of us, and we're just hearing some of that today, and I applaud you for bringing forward a solution to a problem that our citizens have been concerned about after the recent caucus events. But my concern is always sometimes when we move too fast, we might miss some things. And Minnesota is a bit of an outlier when it comes to elections, and we only have to look back to the late 90s to the way the rest of the country looked at us when we had the independent professional wrestler governor. We had one of the most conservative members of the U.S. Senate and probably the most liberal member of the U.S. Senate representing our state. And I'd travel around the country and people would say, what's going on in Minnesota? And I said, well, that's the way we do things. As soon as you guys want to put us in a box, we bust up all those expectations of what people think we are politically. And Minnesotans, I think, historically have had almost a sense of pride in that. And so I think we have to meet the expectations of the citizens. And one of the things that we're trying to solve, I think, is to provide more clarity for citizens of how they're participating. With all these new caucus goers, I talked to a lot of people on caucus day who would say, oh, I'm going to go to my caucus and I'm going to go vote. And I thought, no, you're not. Cast a ballot for a straw poll, and then you'll vote for delegates. You're not voting for president in your primary, but you nod and you say, go participate. But all the election geeks in the room probably had that internal monologue, no, you're not going to vote. But in this particular case, when we're going to set it up to look like an election, Minnesotans are going to have a little bit of a different expectation. And participating in party caucuses is definitely a visible partisan activity. And by all intents and purposes, primaries are partisan activities. I don't think Minnesota voters necessarily see those in the same light, and that's why I am looking to see more conversation about this to make sure that all of those concerns can be addressed so that when we do put something in place, which I think we should, I'm very supportive of that, that we have all of these questions answered, and so that the voting public really understands, A, what they're asking us to do when they say, change this to a presidential primary, and B, what they're doing when they walk into the voting booth. And so that's why I am proposing this amendment, which, sorry I haven't even spoken to, is a study. And it's very limited in scope. It asks some pretty specific questions and would convene quickly and finish their work quickly so that we could stay on task in getting this solution done for the public, because I do think the pace is important, and I appreciate that Representative Sanders is working quickly to resolve this. So that is my amendment, Madam Chair, and happy to hear the discussion.
Right. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Any discussion on the DE1? Chair Sanders.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, thank you, Representative Halverson. Look, I think you adequately described kind of where we're at right now, and you know, I certainly respect where you're coming from with this. I guess just my point, and members, you know, I mean, I guess you can choose which way you want to go. I would say let's stick with what we have for a couple of reasons. One, I think that there are enough states out there that do presidential primary elections that we've been able to model this legislation after. You know, many states have been doing this for a long time. Don't think there's, you know, maybe there's some discussion as to, you know, what our preferences are, but don't think there's anything groundbreaking or necessarily new in the bill. So I would just say, I mean, look, we have a terrific opportunity right now to seize the momentum and to, you know, still have fresh in our minds the experiences of earlier this month. And so, you know, I think while we have the support that we do, really complete bipartisan support on the issue of moving to this, you know, I would just say I think Minnesota is ready to move to a presidential primary.
Any other discussion? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess at this time, and out of fairness to the author as well, because I know you didn't get to see this ahead of time, I'll go ahead and withdraw this amendment and perhaps bring this forward in another way, because I would like to keep our discussion forward about how we're going to make these decisions. So.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. The DE1 has been withdrawn. We are. I believe there's a testifier from the Minnesota Association of County Offices here. Officers? Here to testify. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Debbie Erickson. I'm the Crow Wing County Auditor-Treasurer and the Chair of the Elections Committee for MACO. With regard to House File 3549, MACO does not have an official position, but we did want to let you know a couple of our thoughts and concerns about this bill. As election administrators, our main concerns stem from the cost of a third election in a presidential year, which has been discussed, difficulties of an open versus closed primary, and potential administrative challenges that could be seen. From the cost perspective, we appreciate that the bill contains provisions to provide reimbursement to the local units of government for administration of the presidential primary. Section 13 does outline most of the expected costs that we would anticipate to incur. However, Subdivision 4 notes that if the total amount of the appropriation to the Secretary of State isn't sufficient to cover the full cost, the reimbursement will be based on the number of voters registered in each precinct. We do have a concern that this could have the result of creating an unfunded mandate in part, particularly for some of the smaller precincts, which still have the burdens of the same preparation of larger precincts in terms of publications, equipment preparation, and polling place expenses. And they could actually see higher costs in temporary staff or overtime costs due to those offices with less staff dedicated only to elections. We would recommend that all local costs related to the presidential primary be fully reimbursed to the local units of government. Secondly, we note that there could be some difficulties that could be seen with a closed versus open primary system, which could include potential higher costs associated with ballot preparation and issues with absentee balloting. The Secretary of State's office noted an estimate of 1 million voters statewide that would involve counties having 1 million ballots prepared. However, if voters had to declare a party and were only allowed a ballot for one major party, counties would actually need to prepare double that 1 million ballot count at this point, as ballots would need to be prepared for each party, since we have no current party registration in Minnesota and no history that we would be able to go by to determine what number of ballots would be needed for each party. Absentee balloting would also require some modification to existing applications to require a voter to indicate which ballot would be requested, which would require a change in rules. Finally, we do recognize some potential administrative challenges that may exist with a presidential primary. We did have concerns about the original 46 or 56 days that were noted in the original bill. However, the A3 amendment that you did adopt today took care of our concerns with regard to that. But we would expect a high number of absentee voters given the timing of the election, as many Minnesotans take advantage of warmer climates in the winter. This could potentially have the issues of higher costs associated with absentee balloting. And for those jurisdictions that vote exclusively by mail, there would also need to be some process or procedure items that are taken into consideration, as currently those voters do not submit an application, so there would need to be an indicator on the envelope, which again would require a rule change that would note which ballot was enclosed. Additionally, there are issues with having to have snowbirds who are in a mail ballot precinct would probably need to apply for an absentee ballot, as election mail is non-forwardable mail when it's delivered as well. Finally, the timing of the presidential primary is slated to fall 1 week prior to the annual township March elections, which could cause some jurisdictions to run multiple elections simultaneously and provide additional voter confusion in voting locations and absentee ballot requests. Additionally, the amendment that Chair Sanders offered earlier took care of our other concern with the fact that the default date for the primary caucus would also fall on the March township election, so we appreciate that as well. As election administrators, our chief priorities are the effective and efficient management of election laws and processes, and we hope that all considerations are given to this process as the legislation is moved forward. Thank you, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Any questions for this testifier? Thank you for your testimony. Seeing none, we're back to the bill. Representative Sanders, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, again for another good discussion. I'll renew my motion that House File 3549 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
As amended.
Thank you. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
You are on your way to Ways and Means, Representative Sanders. Representative Sundin, please come forward. Your bill is next.
Just give me your number again.
This is going to take about 45 minutes.
Representative Sundin, welcome to the committee. We're going to try and get through our two final bills in the next 8 minutes. I think we can do it. Representative Sundin, we're make a motion that House File 1674 be referred to the General Register. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee. 1674 is actually somewhat of an agency bill that streamlines the process for approval of sanitary districts. You have in your hand just a map of a project that we have up in Carlton County, Pine County, Legislative District 11A, Legislative District 11B, several municipalities, and I thank the Office of Administrative Hearings for assuming the oversight of this. And 1674 will bring clarity and cost efficiency to the process of creating sanitary districts. It also gives better local notification of changes, additions, subtractions of geographical areas in sanitary district, and improved and better local notification of any changes thereof. I have with me testifiers from Bolton and Mink, and Mr. Kazma, that can actually address any questions about the specific project that I just outlined. And we also have staff from the Office of Administrative Hearings that are prepared to testify at length as to the technical aspects of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. The testifiers can come down to the table if they need to. Welcome to the committee. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, that at-length thing concerns me, just for the record.
Mike.
It's, at least it's before the vote. All right. Welcome to the committee.
Sounds like we're short on time. Chair, members, I'm Mark Kazma with Bolton & Mink. I represent the Moose Lake Windermere Sanitary Sewer District, and the sheet that was passed out to you just now. This bill needs to go through before our client can keep moving forward with a regionalization study for sanitary sewer to help protect our waterways up on the 35 corridor. You can see very plain from the map the different cities and lake areas that are affected. So that's why this bill is important to our client. I'd ask to take any questions if you have any.
Thank you for your testimony. Ma'am, welcome to the committee. Do you have any testimony to add?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tammy Poost. I'm the Chief Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. The bill is just trying to make it easier and quicker for local districts to get these processes through OAH.
All right, excellent. Thank you. Members, any questions? Seeing none, any final discussion to the bill? Seeing none, good job. With that, I'll renew my motion. The House File 1674 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. And thank you for your patience. Members, we have our final blow up on the agenda. I just want to make a quick announcement. Next week is going to be extremely busy, so if you could bring some extra clothes, and we'll try and feed you if we have to. But we could end up having night hearings every evening next week, so just be forewarned. With that, Representative Joaquin, you can come take the gavel, and we will see you guys next week.
Representative Lane, would you like to present House File 3019?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House File 3019 to the General Register, and I have an amendment. The amendment, do you want to do that first? Or?
Yes, why don't you go ahead and describe the amendment and how it will pertain to your bill?
The amendment is just from Ms. Dyson, who just said that in order to do what we're doing here, simple changes in Ramsey County statutes, we need to actually comply with state law by having the county commissioners do a resolution and vote on it, majority vote, to make sure it's done properly.
Okay, would you like to, then what we have, the A1 amendment on the table to put the bill in the order that the author would like it? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's on. Would you like to address your bill?
The bill is very simple for Ramsey County to update three technical pieces controversial areas are in changing it from Personnel Department to Human Resources Department, which they already use that name, but they have to just do it formally. And another one is following federal law on mandated age of retirement. You cannot have a mandated age of requirement, so they're of retirement, so they're removing that. And the third one is a little bit more complicated, so I'll have Jean Gramley from Ramsey County explain.
Ms. Gramley?
Good morning, Ms. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jean Gramling. I'm a manager in the Human Resources Department at Ramsey County. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. As Representative Lane indicated, most of our bill is very simple. One is to address the term of eligibility. The mandatory retirement age, and the other one is just a technical change of the from Personnel Department to the Human Resources Department. The other one is on lines 1.9 and 1.10, where the new language would read, the term of eligibility of eligibles on list shall be determined by the Personnel Director. The term eligibility list is defined in the definitions of Section 383A.281, Subdivision 16, and is as follows. Eligible list means a list of candidates eligible for employment in a specific class. When the county has an open position for which they want to solicit job applications, we first determine the classification of the position. Many different but substantially similar positions may be in the same classification. For instance, in the county, we have nursing positions in different departments. We have corrections nurses, public health nurses, and nurses at our county nursing home. These jobs are often in the same classification, and for the sake of illustration, we can say we have an open position that we're seeking to fill at the nursing home. We'll post the listing. Applications are received and assessed to determine if the applicant has required qualifications. Those that meet the qualifications are contacted about the position at the nursing home, and even if they do not want to be considered for that job at the nursing home but are really interested in a job in the public health department, they still have to remain on the eligibility list. Under the current law, if we don't find a suitable applicant that will accept the position, we can't repost that position until the eligibility list expires, which is 6 months from the posting of the position. And during that time, the departments still have a vacancy in their department. For some positions where the turnover is really high, we have a high number of eligible applicants on the list, the six-month duration isn't a problem for us. But times have changed since when the law was enacted 31 years ago and this restriction was put in place. Many of our positions today call for specific skills, for high levels of training and experience. We're experiencing more instances where jobs remain unfilled while a department waits for an eligible list to expire. This leaves our departments short-staffed, and current employees may be required to work under that pressure and do more work outside of the abundant amount of work they're doing already. Departments may feel pressured to hire somebody from the list who is not considered to be a good fit, and they don't think that they will necessarily be successful in that position. This presents situations where it can be expensive to train new employees. It's not conducive to stability when a new employee does not work out, either for the county, that employee who was let go from the county, or the employees that remain behind. Eligible lists have a purpose, so we're not asking to get rid of them. They can reduce the number of job postings. They help us manage our workforce. They allow eligible applicants to continue to be considered for positions in the event that additional openings in the same classification arise. Providing flexibility in the length of time an eligible list must be maintained is helpful to the county, our workforce, the clients we serve, and our taxpayers. And as Representative Lane mentioned earlier, the second section of the bill is related to changing the term personnel to human resources under Section 2, and Section 3 of the bill repeals the language in 383A.295 that requires employees to retire by the age of 70. So if you have any questions, I can answer them.
Thank you. I believe we'll open it up to questions unless Representative Lane has anything to add.
No, that's good.
Okay, and I believe Representative Nelson has a question.
Just one question, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. So there's on the eligibility, the list being open, there's going to be no determining time, and how long are you looking at holding a list open? having worked in the public sector in the past, I've seen games played with lists and applications, and you could get a whole bunch of applications in, and there's nobody on there you want to hire. You could then repost it the very next day and basically eliminate a whole bunch of people and say, well, we don't want those people, so then they're going to go through the process again. I agree that 6 months may be a little bit too long, but totally indeterminate gives me some queasiness in my stomach. And I don't see anyone here from the public sector unions to speak on this, but it's a concern I have.
Thank you, Mr. Representative and Chair. In Ramsey County, when we post a job, we would list the time that the eligible list is going to be good for before it is posted. So that would eliminate any possibility of taking a list and saying we don't like who's on it and we're going to repost it. We would identify before the job is posted whether the list would be good for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, whatever we wanted to do. So that should alleviate the concerns that you have on that, hopefully. And with the representative or the unions, representatives from the unions, we have informed the Teamsters of this, and they showed no opposition to it. And we've informed AFSCME about it too, and they said that they were not actively opposed to it.
Okay, just wanted to raise the okay. question, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Lane, would you like to have the final word?
I think we're ready to go and leave here. I renew my motion for House File 3019 to go to the General Register as amended.
Representative Lane renews her motion to move House File 3019 as amended to the General Registry. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's moving to the General Registry, and as Representative Sanders, Chair Sanders said before, it sounds like next week's going to be a full week, and we're going to be spending a lot of time together, and maybe we can bring some snacks.
What was your plan hearing next week? Can you tell us?
You know what? Let me see. I had one that almost went down and stake up finance. Maybe we can bring it back to this committee. No, I'm sorry. I'm sure staff will have those posted as soon as they have those listed. But I will bring cookies next week. How's that? Okay. We are adjourned.